From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it right now. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Father, thank you for the way that you do provide for us. Pray that you would pour your overwhelming blessing and wisdom on the president, on the vice president, his cabinet, and his team. Pray that you would energize him, that you would give him wise counsel and use him for your kingdom's sake and for our nation and world's sake. In the name of Jesus, I ask.
We may be living in a diverse, secular, pluralistic society, but there is such a thing as a national prayer breakfast. It happens every year, and this year in particular, it was a perfect model of the kind of sectarian, divisive, evangelical, theocratic language that our founders would denounce. Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline will be here to address that and many other urgent issues at the intersection of religion, government, and politics.
We hear language that singles out immigrants and suggests entire religious communities are complicit in violence. Where does this stop? Because that's not the America we want.
It's been a priority for those of us working at the intersection of religion, government, and politics to expose and oppose the seemingly endless expressions of anti-Muslim sentiment stoked in this country since 9/11. The injustices of Islamophobia are easy to see. Less so are the injuries and impact of that kind of divisive bigotry. Now a new book offers an unvarnished look at life in America for one Muslim, Victor Begg. But first,
this was not a particularly good speech, but what it lacked in quality, it made up in length.
It's telling that all of the various responses to this year's belated State of the Union address, one thing you didn't hear was surprise. I guess that's because we're at a point in our national discourse and politics where pretty much anything can be said, and nobody bats an eye. Still, we want to analyze what was said and what wasn't. And so I am happy to be joined by political management expert and my good friend, Greg LaBelle. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
That was a very apt intro.
What stood out for you in this year's State of the Union address?
Okay, apropos of what you just said, I am about to make a public confession. I didn't watch the entire speech. I got about an hour into it, and this is really sort of my response to your question. Mm-hmm. I realized that it was sort of a waste of my time for exactly the reasons that you just said, and I think that most Americans probably reacted that way. And there were sort of two reasons, one of which is that the stuff he talked about, if you just look at some of the proposals that were sort of peppered through the speech, you could say there are some interesting things here. Mm-hmm. But I think we have learned that none of what was said at the State of the Union will have any bearing on what happens after that. Mm-hmm. I went after the speech and looked back at his last two speeches, his mm-hmm. last State of the Union and his address to Congress 2 years ago. A lot of the same stuff was in those two speeches, both in terms of call to bipartisanship and particular programs that he was talking about. Mm-hmm. Infrastructure certainly was one of them. He talked about health care and family leave. All of this stuff has been in his speeches. Nothing ever happens. So the State of the Union has become, for me, time that's not particularly well spent. To answer the other part of your question, the most interesting thing, quite frankly, was watching the Speaker of the House and her reactions to the things that the president was saying. So there's my confession.
Was there something left unsaid that you thought to be a particularly glaring omission?
He had glancing references to all kinds of things, but I don't think he really addressed just the sort of general state of dissatisfaction, dis-ease in the country. I mean, there were allusions to it, and I think that relates specifically to the election, to the last election cycle. The president's not going to come to the union and say, boy, I screwed up, and, you know, we really took a beating. But when this has happened before, it happened to President Obama, it happened to President Clinton. When a president's party takes it on the chin in midterms, usually there's an effort to sort of recalibrate, and it didn't happen. Again, there were some words there, but there is no real attempt. And you pull out those few moments, talking about eliminating the HIV-AIDS epidemic, talking about paid family leave, and all you have is just more of the same sort of vindictive kind of threats and nastiness toward people who don't agree with him. So I think that's what was missing. It was a smart strategy of saying, we need to recalibrate this. It didn't happen.
I'm going to read you a sentence and tell me the first words that come to your mind after I've said it.
Oh, Lord.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation.
The first word that comes to mind is outrageous. there's no connection between the two. And that's the thing that he doesn't understand. Is the president going to veto a piece of legislation coming from the Congress on infrastructure or on drug pricing? Is he going to veto that because there are investigations open? That seems to be what he's saying. What's the connection between the two? There isn't any.
Mm-hmm.
It's outrageous.
Well, Greg, was this simply a partisan speech, a campaign speech, rally speech, or was there anything that felt like it was addressed to all Americans?
No, to the last question. It was the beginning of, I think, his 2020 election language, and it was, as I was watching it, I thought, in some ways, this is his rally speech with his indoor voice. And I think it was a combination of the two. I don't think there was really any serious attempt to break new ground, to open new doors. And all we had to do was wait till the tweeting started when he attacked Congressman Schiff as a political hack.
Yeah. It
took him no time at all to get there. Again, I find myself just keep going back to that. Are we surprised? No. This is exactly what we've seen since this guy's been in the public square, and there's absolutely no reason to expect to see anything different. Media went for too long every time he gave a speech where he read it from the teleprompter going, oh, good, he's finally being presidential. No, he's not. This is not in his wheelhouse.
Am I alone in feeling that even this ritual of our democracy was somehow cheapened by the transparent staging and made-for-TV feeling of this year's event?
Well, I think to some extent State of the Union addresses have always had underlying political overtones and intentions, and that's okay. But there were other things going on as well. And I think that what this president has done is it's not limited to the State of the Union address. It's limited to many, many other things. I think he has demeaned the nature of our political institutions and our political dramas, like the speech. And I think he does that on a regular basis, and he doesn't care.
Greg, what'd you think of the response from Stacey Abrams?
I'm a big fan of Stacey Abrams. I had the honor of meeting her when she first started running for governor because we have some mutual friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard her speak, and I was completely blown away. And I grabbed her campaign manager and spoke with her a little bit about what a remarkable candidate she was working for. And I think that showed in the response. I did go back to the TV and watch the response. And I thought she did a terrific job. First African-American woman to give the response. She is a woman of integrity. She is a woman who is very articulate and I think is in many ways emblematic of the future of the Democratic Party and certainly considered a rising star in the party. And I think her performance proved that. I think Her speech was measured. It was thoughtful. It got to the point. It laid out some of the things that the president said that the Democratic Party strongly disagrees with, some of the things he said that were simply untrue, and provided a really clear alternative to what people had heard in the previous speech.
Yeah.
I think she was great.
Well, I liked her confession that she did not want the president to fail, but she did want him to tell the truth.
Yes, thank you. That was the high point of the speech. I think that was the line that sort of pulled that whole thing together. And I think her talking about her growing up, the challenges that she and her family have faced over the years were important. And leading to that statement about not wanting him to fail but wanting to tell the truth was just a brilliant way to pull up that speech together. I agree.
What do you think are the biggest obstacles the Democratic Party faces in presenting a unified front that inspires trust from a really cynical and exhausted electorate? Is the current leadership able to play a role in the healing that I think most of us see as desperately needed in our nation?
Let's start with the presidential contenders. I think we're setting ourselves up for a robust discussion of policy and a robust discussion of who can most successfully carry the banner of the Democratic Party into the election and stop this president's second term.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great deal of talent there. There are some challenges that each of them face. I think that they do stand in some ways in contrast to the leadership in the House and Senate, specifically in the House of Representatives, because they will be playing, in light of what's going on in the legislative calendar over the next year, and that puts some of them in different places. We've got some lanes that we always have in these things. We've got the Progressive Reformer Group, we've got the middle of the roaders, and we've got some more conservative. And the interesting thing this time is there's not sort of one in each. There's at least two or three in each of those lanes. And that means that the most important thing they're going to have to do is distinguish themselves from every, first in their lane and then in the whole group. And what goes on in the House and Senate will have a great deal of influence on how successful various candidates are in doing that. And we don't know how that's going to play out yet because we don't know exactly what the challenges are going to be and what Pelosi and Schumer are able to cobble together.
Yeah.
I have to say that I think that Pelosi and Schumer have been working extremely well together,
mm-hmm.
and that's not always the case, so it's nice to see.
Greg, you've worked inside your share of presidential campaigns. When you look at the declared Democratic presidential candidates so far, I'm curious what you're thinking and if there's anyone that really stands out for you as having a well-crafted message.
The first thing I think is that the Democrats have never seen anything quite like this. I look back quite a ways, and there was almost always one sort of middle-of-the-road leader in the process, and then a challenger. Bernie Sanders played that role against Clinton last time. Obama played that role to a large extent against Clinton in 2008. Howard Dean played that role with John Kerry in 2004, and so on and so on and so on. That's not going to be the case this time. People have two jobs. They have to distinguish themselves among the people who fall into whichever lane they're falling into, conservative, liberal, middle of the road,
mm-hmm.
and then distinguish themselves from remaining people in the other lanes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's really different in terms of how this plays out this time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of messages, I've got to honestly say it's a little early to be figuring out messages because they're all figuring out messages.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that Kamala Harris's speech, announcement speech, was a strong speech, and I think that she probably is a little bit ahead of the others, but we still haven't heard from some others as well. The sheer diversity of this crowd, I think, has some influence on how that's going to play out. I mean, we have a number of women. We have a number of people of color. We've got a gay mayor running. That's going to make it more difficult. And I guess if there's something that worries me, and I'm not sure that it should or how I place it, but we know that when the Republicans were facing this plethora of contenders 4 years ago, the guy who floated to the top was the guy who was the most outrageous. I hope that the contenders for the Democratic nomination don't see that that's the model to follow. I don't think they will, but they might.
What should we be keeping our eyes on going forward in this early stage of the campaign?
I think probably the best thing to do is keep an eye out for the people, a couple of people who have not jumped in to the race yet. Obviously, Joe Biden is one of them. Mm-hmm. He continues to be at the top of the polls. Most of that is because more people know his name than anyone else on the list. But he does bring a great deal of experience in government. He has proven to be less than ideal as a presidential candidate, having gone for it twice and not achieved it. Mm-hmm. The other person to keep an eye on who is not announced yet is Senator Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. I think that Amy Klobuchar may have the kind of demeanor and seriousness of purpose and understanding of the issues that may give her a little bit of an edge in that respect. The other thing to keep an eye on is how much money people are raising and how well they use the new media, free and digital media.
Until his retirement, Greg LaBelle taught political management at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where he continues to lead the semester abroad program. Greg has held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance and has worked inside several presidential campaigns. All of that adds up to the kind of expertise we so badly need to make even a little sense of what we see happening in our government and politics today. And we are grateful that we have access to Greg. Thanks so much for being with us this time around on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for inviting me, Welton. Take care.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. It's rush hour at the intersection of religion, government, and politics in America. We'll hear how Interfaith Alliance is working to get the traffic moving from Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. And later, the author of a compelling new book, Our Muslim Neighbors. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. There's an awful lot going on at the intersection of religion, government, and politics in the country right now. That means Interfaith Alliance is even more busy than usual, and that means Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline is deeply engaged in that awful lot that's going on. I'm happy to have him join me right now on State of Belief Radio. Jack, thanks for making time to be with us again.
It's always a pleasure and a privilege, Welton.
The annual National Prayer Breakfast took place this past Thursday. What did you hear that was of particular concern to you?
Well, the first thing I heard that was of particular concern, Welton, is that the National Prayer Breakfast was taking place. Mm. I actually had an opportunity to be on a conference call with Senator Lankford and Senator Coons, who were the co-chairs of this breakfast. And I asked them specifically if, though it is legal, such a breakfast presided over by two United States senators was not a poke in the eye to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And both of them answered in the negative. Senator Lankford suggested that because we only have one National Prayer Breakfast, we could almost say that the other 364 days of the year were promoting atheism. And Senator Coons said, I think correctly, that the kind of fellowship that the breakfast celebrates is important in the Senate and that they do their best to be as inclusive as possible, even though he was well aware that most of the people there were followers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing that concerned me, is that there is no sense that this is an uncomfortable moment for those of us who consider the Constitution to be determinative.
Mm-hmm.
But I also heard the president repeat many of the themes of his State of the Union. His respect for unborn children and newly born children that stands in contrast to his disrespect for the foreign-born children of people trying to come to this country. I heard him praise the Second Lady, Mrs. Pence, for her good work teaching school children, but emphasized that she was teaching in a Christian school, which discriminates against admission. And I heard him praise foster agencies that can restrict where they will place children on the basis of the faith of the foster parents. So there was a lot to be concerned about.
Has the president's recent bent on talking about prayer in school and teaching the Bible in school, where is that coming from?
Well, it is, first of all, coming from a place of appealing to his base. The very first thing he said this morning was, I will never let you down.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not speaking to the American people. He was speaking to the religious right. And I only wish he was as sincere about the oath he took to uphold the Constitution as he was about the declaration he made to promote the agenda of the religious right.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's coming from.
Honestly, Jack, is there any way for this kind of tradition to continue at all without violating church-state separation rules?
I guess technically, Welton, it doesn't violate church-state separation rules. This is a voluntary gathering of people exercising their free conscience rights under the First Amendment. But it is an enormously uncomfortable moment for our country because it specifically excludes people who do not profess a theistic tradition. And it is pretty clear if you look at the language of what the president said and the other remarks that were made and who was on the program, that people who are not literalist Christians are at best guests at this National Prayer Breakfast. It is not an inclusive morning. It is a right-wing evangelical Christian morning to which other people are invited as guests.
Let me get back to now the topic of religious influence where it doesn't belong. We're raised the troubling issue of the campaign called Project Blitz on this show several times already. But I wish you would talk about the latest developments that are raising increased alarm for Interfaith Alliance and your partners.
We are seeing, not surprisingly, we're seeing a sudden spate of bills being introduced in state legislatures, including my own Virginia, that would establish Bible study courses in public high schools.
Mm-hmm.
They are framed as study of the Bible as literature or its contribution to Western civilization, but it's unquestionably the inculcation of the Bible as being a foundational piece of literature for Americans. Now, it certainly is for certain Americans, maybe even for most Americans, but from our perspective at Interfaith Alliance, the notion that the Bible holds a privileged place among all of the subjects that might be introduced into more and more limited high school curricula strikes me as a clear violation of the Establishment Clause, which I remind our listeners doesn't just prohibit Congress from establishing a religion, but prohibits Congress from establishing religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that people who are not believers have the same rights that you and I do as believers.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what kind of efforts are taking place that you would consider hopeful in reducing the influence of these kinds of misguided policies?
The 100% most effective tactic is for people to be informed and to communicate their concern to their legislators. And that is, in this particular instance, not their members of Congress, but their state legislators and their state senators who hold the key to introducing these laws at a state level that can change the culture of our public school system and our communities in general. I want to remind people that the presence of right-leaning religious legislators across the country is the result of a decades-long campaign by the religious right to put people who share their values in positions of legislation and influence. And it is all the more important not just for us to communicate with them, being in the positions they are now, but to examine carefully the records of people who serve in state and local government and make sure that there is honest and comprehensive discussion of whether the values that they are promoting are constitutional values or religious values.
Hmm. Jack, I know there are limits to what you can say on the sad events that have been taking place in the Virginia State House, but because you have worked so long in these circles, I wonder if there is insight you could shed on what has been playing out with the governor there.
There is a phrase in Hebrew from Jewish jurisprudence that is nogea badavar, someone who has a special relationship to an issue, a vested interest in a certain outcome. And that's me. I have two children who work in Virginia state government. And so I am indeed limited by what I can say, and I am limited by my love for my kids and not wanting to put them in an awkward position. I will say this. It is a remarkably fractious time in Virginia history. There has not been a resignation from the governorship in Virginia since the Civil War. And though there is a succession delineated in the Virginia Constitution, there are no procedures for what happens once an office is vacated by succession. And given that all three elected officials at the top of Virginia government right now are in a tenuous position, the troubling aspects of this are not just philosophical, and they're not just about relationships among the various constituencies in Virginia. There's also a real concern about the stability of our governance system, because we're smack in the middle, literally in the middle, of Virginia's relatively brief legislative session. And a budget and the laws that flow from that budget need to be passed in the midst of this triple-headed crisis. So it's a very difficult time in Virginia. If you are praying, folks, please pray for the Commonwealth of Virginia. And if you're not, a good thought and a level head would be helpful as well. And you might also keep my kids in your thoughts, too.
Is there even a chance that other elected leaders who may have secrets from the past may learn from this debacle? Or is it just too central to human nature for anyone with skeletons in the closet to just keep hoping that nobody will ever discover them?
I have always told my kids, from the time they were very little, that everything they do counts. And I've learned that the hard way. I'm sure you've learned that the hard way, Weldon. We all make mistakes. What we do intentionally, however, is different than what we do out of ignorance or undeveloped sensitivity. And what's not clear to me with any human being is whether they have done the kind of self-inventory that all of our faith traditions recommend that allow them to come to terms either shortly after or a long time after they've committed the inevitable human mistakes we all make to do the right thing about correcting that. Look, to refer to what's going on in Virginia right now, all of the transgressions that are being discussed happened a long time ago. They happened 15 years ago, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and these are actions that these three gentlemen have had a long time to come to terms with, and they're just coming out now. All of us, I think, have blemishes on our records that we look back at and regret. The question is, what have we done about them? I know that there have been people, thank God, I don't think I've done anything criminal, but I do know that I have, in the course of my social life, acted insensitively with people, both male and female, with whom I've had a social relationship and wanted to change it or end it. If I could take back those moments, I would, and if I knew those people and where they were, I hope I would have the strength to reach out and correct this, even all these years into my long, long marriage. But not everybody has that self-awareness. And most people, frankly, live in the present. They don't think too much about the past. All of this is playing into this crisis in Virginia, and I think that I hope that there are a lot of people in public life and private life who are doing the necessary self-reflection now.
For a long, long time now, the Interfaith Alliance's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award ceremony has been important, and especially important to you and me. I understand that you're able to give us a sneak peek of what may be coming up this year, and I'd like to know if you could just spill the beans for our listeners.
Absolutely. We are very excited that we have two of our honorees who are going to be part of the Cronkite Award series this year. William Webster, who is a former federal judge, the former head of the FBI, and the former head of the CIA, a longtime public servant with an unblemished record of integrity, and what I think will probably surprise listeners who haven't paid close attention to his career, a long legacy of doing the right thing in areas of government that had once been conducted in inappropriate ways in the government. He really has done a lot for freedom of religion, for race and sexual orientation and gender. He's done a lot in both the FBI and the CIA. He will be accepting the Cronkite Award this year. And participating in that program as an award winner also will be longtime CBS Radio White House correspondent Peter Mayer, who will be conducting a public conversation with Mr. Webster during the course of that event. We also expect that there will be a second Cronkite event in this calendar year. The first one will happen here in Washington, D.C. We are expecting the second one to happen in New York. I have cornered the person who is most deserving of this award, at least who hasn't received it yet. And I don't want to say his name because I've almost got him to say yes. And we will be able to award him, as well as a very special guest from our founding, which was 25 years ago. And we'll be talking more about the 25th anniversary on future editions of State of Belief.
Interfaith Alliance is doing such important work every day at the policy level, at the educational level, and at the watchdog level, protecting faith and freedom for all of us.
Well, there is no more important work that we do week to week than the broadcast of State of Belief. So I thank you for being at the helm of this ship, and I thank our producer, Ray, for the work that he does as well, and I especially thank our listeners for keeping up with what we're doing.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, defending true faith and freedom for all. Among the important initiatives the Alliance supports is this program, as Jack just said. And Jack, I'm very grateful for that support. And as always, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure. Take good care.
The book is titled Our Muslim Neighbors, Achieving the American Dream, an Immigrant's Memoir. The author is a leading entrepreneur, activist, and educator. His name is Victor Begg, and I am delighted to have him with us today on State of Belief Radio. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Reverend Getty.
Well, in addition to a well-written, empathetic look at life for Muslims in this country, I think it's important to note that you're coming at this from a place of success. You're talking about the impact that divisiveness and bigotry can have on the human spirit, even as you were able to overcome those obstacles personally. What made you want to write this book?
Reverend Gary, 60% Americans don't know a Muslim. That's per a Pew study. Yet many are our neighbors, our co-workers. My family story, in all its vulnerabilities, offer a window into the daily life and beliefs of ordinary Muslim Americans. You get to know who they really are. As an accidental activist, I write about the experiences of a vulnerable minority. Mine is a true blue story. I write about ultimately achieving the American dream after much hard work and many ups and downs.
Victor, would you talk about your history of activism and leadership in community building and breaking down barriers?
Well, I got into this accidentally, really. One event after another kind of pulled me in. I'm retired now, but retirement is far away. A businessman. I wanted to go back to my business. However, things were happening, and I came to this country in 1970. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, as a student, we never heard of anything that like we hear now because of the wars in the Middle East. Of course, there were problems in the Middle East, but they were primarily related to land dispute. Islam was not in the headlines. Then suddenly we had the hostage situation in Iran, which kind of put Islam into the forefront. But even then, that was primarily focused on Iranians. I remember when I was going to school in University of Detroit, there were a whole bunch of Iranian students. Iran was a good guy at that time, and the next thing you know, they all disappeared, and the hostage crisis started. Ted Koppel, if people don't remember him, he's the Anderson Cooper of CNN Today at the time, and he was on every night, reciting day by day. Day one, day 10, day 20. And, you know, that weighed on me. I was basically a secular Muslim. I performed rituals. You know, I prayed when I could. However, I was not into religion. But, and I got very conscious of it. And I tried to get on the radio talk shows, try to find a way to explain that what's going on is not really something I care about. And then Imam Khomeini doubled down and issued a fatwa. Well, that really brought Islam into focus. Now, what should I do? I write. So I wrote an op-ed piece for the Detroit News and Free Press. And what did they do? They declined. I thought, you know, papers would welcome an opposing viewpoint, but they didn't want to print my paper. And primarily, I think it was because there was no Muslim American community per se. They called us Indian Muslims or Pakistani Muslims or Arab Muslims or whatever. So it was kind of unique for them to hear a Muslim voice representing the Muslim community. And I used to advertise with them. So what I did, I said, okay, well, you're not going to print my op-ed piece. I'll buy an ad space. Guess what they charged me?
What?
$13,000.
Oh, my God.
To put less than a quarter page of an ad. And I said, well, it's a nonprofit effort. No, you got to pay the full political price for that. So anyways, I mean, that's how I got involved, when you say accidentally. And then one thing started into the other, and I wanted to learn more about my religion to respond to all that's being talked about my faith. So I became a little more religious. You know, I married a Hindu woman. I was born in India. And neither of them were religious. However, she accepted Islam, and especially after her kids were born, you know, you always think of leading them with religious values. And they reconciled with American values. I don't have a single doubt about it. We all believe in the values every the neighbor believes, and we pursue our dreams like everyone else does. So anyways, I got active.
In the book, you emphasize the importance of getting to know each other personally, that antipathy to a demonized group can only be broken down when you get to know members of that group. And this is a lesson that we've heard from so many guests over the years. And so I'm curious as to when you yourself came to this understanding about the one-on-one relationships.
Well, I have many, many interesting stories. Let me just tell you the most recent one.
Okay.
We moved to Florida to retire. You know, retirement is still not in my life. I'm very active here as well. I build the interfaith community here, participating actively. I write for the papers, and I'm doing the cultural competency training to the police department.
Hmm.
Well, anyways, going back to the what the question you asked, we moved here for a quiet life, and my wife wears a hijab. You know, this is the first time we had the opportunity to live with the 90 other neighbors in a condominium building. So initially, we were apprehensive. And because my wife wears a hijab, they all know we're Muslims. And we pretty much represent the 1% of the population in America, since we are one of the 90 neighbors. But, you know, I found my neighbors, and it's a conservative Republican area, very friendly. You know, when I started writing my memoir, I wrote 450 pages of manuscript. I'm not trying to scare the listeners. The book is only 280 pages.
Right.
But the point I was trying to make was my neighbor, who is an English teacher, went through the entire 450 pages and proofread initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then my wife is on the welcome committee. And we feel very, very at home with our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to know more about Muslims and Islam. You know, we go for a weekly, they call it Thirsty Thursdays,
mm-hmm.
An evening when the condominium association members get together. And then now they know we don't eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, I find when you get to know people personally, you educate them, you learn from them, and you become friends.
Mm-hmm. You've done an awful lot of bridging divides and helping people get to know each other. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the long-term prospects of interfaith, intercultural cooperation in our country?
Well, I like to see the optimism trickles down from the top.
Mm-hmm.
And the call for unity comes from the top. And I feel with our dysfunctional leadership, you know, we have a situation where it's divide and rule, you know, and the fear-mongering. And things had gotten better after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
much better.
Mm-hmm.
And since the charged political environment started, things got worse. Now, where my optimism comes from is through individuals working with each other,
mm-hmm.
person by person. And one of the reasons I wrote my book is I have hope in my next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I have hope in people spreading unity through knowing each other.
If you had the opportunity to talk directly to our national political leaders right now, what would be your message to them?
I would say get to know the stories of people like me. Since immigration and Muslim ban and such things are being promoted, And I'm saying this as a Muslim, as a member of a minority. It's my story of how I built a successful life in a new country. And along the way, I became an accidental activist, building interfaith coalitions and advocating inclusion. So our stories need to be shared. I wish President Trump could have shared one of these stories at his State of the Union address. That's why I say it's so important to have at the top a true effort to bring our communities together, to unite our communities together. And that would be my message, to do all you can to unite America. Unity means patriotism. And we all, no matter what background we come from, this is the greatest country on earth. And we want to represent this country to the rest of the world, because there is no one, there is really no one who could bring that message to a torn world. So I say, do all you can to unite us as Americans and promote the American values.
Victor Begg is a retired entrepreneur, co-founded the Muslim Unity Center Mosque in Bloomfield Hills, and is a founding member of the Interfaith Leadership Council of Metro Detroit. Victor Begg's new book is titled Our Muslim Neighbors, Achieving the American Dream, An Immigrant's Memoir. And as we wrap up, I want to be sure to mention an important resource along these same lines from Interfaith Alliance. The publication is titled What is the Truth About American Muslims? And you can find it online at interfaithalliance.org. We'll also link to it from stateofbelief.com. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me. And let me say that this is all for our next generation. And I have my 2-month-old grandchild here, and I want to see he lives in an America that I came to live in 1970, when I was so optimistic, and I said, it's easy to be a Muslim in America. Mm. I want to bring back that optimism. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you. Now, if you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.